Welcome to First Impressions, the podcast where we talk about our love for Jane Austen and give a big middle finger to all the haters. I am Kristen and I'm joined by Maggie.
Hello!
And today we're talking about the BBC radio drama version of Mansfield Park, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Edmund and Felicity Jones as Fanny.
Felicity Jones, as everyone knows, from, Northanger Abbey. What is it? I got everyone, listeners, dear listeners, gentle listeners, I am now another year older, if not necessarily a year wiser. And also, I can't remember anything anymore. So middle age is coming for you all. Thank you. I'm 44. Can you believe it?
I cannot.
I really wasn't sure I'd live this. No, I'm not. Just kidding. but yes, so Felicity Jones, who we all know as Kathy in Northanger Abbey, making her second Austen heroine debut in the BBC radio Mansfield Park.
Yes, and some other notable cast members, David Tennant.
It's so good.
It's so good. And I never realized the character of Tom Bertram, was such a comic character until
It makes you like Tom.
Yeah, it's just so funny.
It just really goes to show, like, what having amazing actors can do for this is like what we always say, where I love Mary Crawford because Hayley Atwell played her in a not great adaptation, but it just makes me love the character. I feel like David Tennant has done that for Tom Bertram. Who would have thought? Do you want me to kind of go down? I've got the list right here. Do you want me to say some of the
I'll just toss out one other one, which was the Henry Crawford in this version was exceptional. And changed, like, my whole feelings about everything. It changed my perspective on the whole. Anyway, but I didn't look up the cast list. And we were just chatting. And I was like, who is that guy? He was so good. Who was he, Maggie?
James Callett, who I'm sure our listeners know because he was in Bridget Jones's Diary. He played her gay best friend in Bridget Jones's Diary. And Kristen and I know him as Dr. Baltar. Battlestar Galactica. But remember, he was also in Austenland.
Yes, he was.
A gay character in that too, actually, didn't
character.
He?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He is just incredible. I mean, yeah, I was like fangirling all over once I realized who he was. But even before that, his performance just really moved me.
I want to shout out some other people. The narrator, so basically Jane Austen, is played by Amanda Root, who, of course, we all know from Persuasion. Benedict Cumberbatch is Edmund Bertram. Felicity Jones is Fanny Price. James Callis is Henry Crawford. Jemima Rooper is Julia Bertram, who I love because she's in Lost in Austen. She's the main character in Lost in Austen, where she like travels through a Narnia-like door into the pages of Pride and Prejudice. It's really fun. Mary Crawford is played by an actress called Susan Lynch, where you don't know the name, but if you look up her picture, I promise you've seen her before. She's an Irish actress. And Mr. Rushworth was Toby Jones, and I immediately knew it was him because he's so distinctive sounding to me, at least.
Toby? Him?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And of course, I can't think of Toby Jones without thinking of him from the MCU, where he plays like this little German fascist, basically, in Hydra. But I just think he's so cute. I love him so much. And I mean, David Tennant, they fleshed him out a little more, I think. Well, everybody had more dialogue because it's a radio drama, so it's almost all dialogue. We had a little bit of narration kind of at the front and end, kind of drive home the big theme of this Mansfield Park, which is kind of change is coming to Mansfield Park and how will everyone respond to it. But a lot of dialogue was written and added, so everyone kind of got more than they would in the book to say. But everyone was so great. I loved it. I mean, I loved it. Kristen, you are the Mansfield Park expert. What did you think?
I loved it too. And I think the most exceptional thing about it is that the person who wrote it, adapted it for radio, whose name I don't even know, shame on me, I'm sure you have it, did a fantastic...
Lynn Colan. And produced by Sally Avens.
Did a fantastic job writing additional dialogue that, first of all, didn't sound modern. It sounded like it could... It weaved in seamlessly with Austen's dialogue, which is hard to do. It's like deceptively hard to do. But it also casts additional light on the characters. Absolutely. And some scenes were made up out of whole cloth, and they were these little grace notes. Yeah, a scene would have happened here where X person would have said this and Y person would have said that plot-wise, but gave a new depth to the character of Fanny Price in a way that I loved, that I really dug, that made her a genuinely likable character. And they didn't do it by making her spunky. They did it by making her sympathetic, intelligent, emotionally intelligent, and also made her kind of a counselor to others, to Mariah, to Julia, in a way that makes you like her a lot more than just corner sitting judgy Fanny.
It made me like Fanny Price. It made me like Edmund. It made me like Tom. It really made Fanny being in love with Edmund and him being totally clueless feel real. And a lot of it is the writing, and I'd say 50% writing, 50% performance, because everyone is fantastic, right? But I mean, it made me like Edmund, and that's not
easy
to do. But they had genuine chemistry too. And I wonder if they were in the same room, because sometimes with recording these things, you were just in a booth by yourself. And if that's the case, then everyone did a really incredible job, because it's hard to have chemistry with nobody. But Edmund even had a little like witty repartee, you know, they would tease each other a little bit, and you could really feel their closeness and the friendship. That on her side was clearly something more. I don't know. I just loved it. And everyone knows Mansfield Park is not my favorite. But as soon as it ended, I share an office with my husband. I looked at Bayard and I was like, that was amazing. I'm going to listen to it again. And I started at the beginning and listened to it again immediately. I loved it so much.
The thing about the book is Edmund is the Pygmalion and he carves Fanny. And mentally, she's just a satellite of him. Whereas in this adaptation, she's been raised, yes, with his ideals, but she does have her own mind and her own morals that she can reflect back at, you know, and in one scene, they even argue, they fight, man. And that was exhilarating to me in a way. I don't know. It's not Mansfield Park, like it takes that sinister element away from it, but it certainly makes it a more living, breathing story.
Absolutely. I don't know. I think that for me, Mansfield Park has, it's almost like some people who try to read Lord of the Rings and they can't get past the like really long descriptions of what the trees are like, yeah, or the entire history of the elves. And so it makes it more difficult to dig into what the story is about. And Mansfield Park for me is, unfortunately, I can't get through some of, it's not filler, but there's things that are surrounding the story that make it very difficult for me to penetrate it to the emotions that are inside of it. And the dramatization sort of has to jettison all of that to just get to the characters and their relationships and the story. And so it made it so much more accessible to me and for me to really love it and understand it. There's such a beautiful scene at the end between Fanny and Tom where he's recovering from his illness when he has decided to, you know, he kind of learned his lesson, I guess you could say. He's turned over a new leaf. They're in the garden talking to each other and she's kind of pointing out the plants and giving their Latin names and what they do. And he's kind of teasing with her and being funny, but also interested. And it was such a great little scene. And it told me so much about their characters. I loved it.
Oh, I loved it too. And that was another little grace note. Like there were so many of them making Fanny a naturalist, mm-hmm, you know, and bringing her, connecting her to that natural world and connecting her to Mansfield Park in a more, I don't know, organic way.
Yeah, but like she literally loves the property so much. She knows everything about it from like the smallest little plant here to like one bush where it's like she knows that this branch is always bent on that bush. So when she gets shoved into it, it's not a big deal. Things like that were really.
Yeah. And that's
another. She falls over Mr. Crawford when she finds out William is coming. And he's like, oh, I fared better than the bush. And she's like, oh, no. That one's always been wonky.
I loved that. And he goes, I know how it feels. And that's the other thing. He gets a lot of witty dialogue. You get to actually hear Henry Crawford joking around and being funny, which I loved as well. And he has great chemistry with Felicity Jones also. And so the tension of the latter half of Mansfield Park, when he's courting her and she is resisting him.
And as a listener, I'm like, girl, go for it. Like, yeah. This is, yeah, right? What a great match. Like, oh my God. And so it really also, you know, people debate, should she have married him or not? Would he have run off with Mariah if she had said yes? I think it kind of really makes that, you know, it seems like she would have been really happy with him and he seemed to like her. Like, who knows what would have happened?
Oh my God. Now I'm saying so many things, but I want to interject too, that it was so hot, like him and his monologue about how he really deserves her. I mean, you're just 100% engaged. And Mary Crawford and Edmund, you get to hear
them.
The
play. And I'm fanning myself. You can't see it, but that was pretty hot.
That was hot shit. And no other adaptation has ever made me believe in Edmund and Mary Crawford the way it did with this one. So it emotion.
Sure, yeah. I'm pretty sure Benedict Cumberbatch has chemistry with like a rock. But I literally was thinking, maybe we should watch a version of Lover's Vow. Like, it's pretty good.
I know. It's just like, oh, you taught me love. You can teach me love. It's like, shit.
And him, he's got a hot voice too, right? Benedict Cumberbatch. Like, he could read the phone book. No, it was really great.
So, and I hate to just jump in and like say all the things because I'm so excited to like talk about it just in general. And I've just like hit all of my notes already.
Yeah, no, say all the things. I will just respond to what you say. And I just want to say that I'm so glad you liked it because I loved it so much. But I know that Mansfield Park is so special to you. It was going to like really be heartbreaking if I loved it so much and you were like, this is terrible. I was just going to be so devastated.
Oh no, I'm a red-blooded woman, man. I can be seduced by Benedict Cumberbatch's voice just like any of us. I will say I tried to listen to this before, like I already owned it, and it's always hard with a story you're really, really familiar with at the very beginning because you're like, yes, I know she's moving to Mansfield. I know. And that part was pretty straight ahead, the beats like Mrs. Norris and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, it's a radio drama. I don't really listen to things without picture because I don't know. I get very
angry. That's right. You're not a podcast person, which is that great irony.
I had to play Candy Crush while I was listening to this, and then I cleaned my bathroom. So
totally valid.
Totally valid.
I mean, I listened while I worked, actually, because I have a type of job where I can unless I'm writing, I can listen to things.
Yeah.
So when I'm looking through mountains of medical records or whatever, I listen to stuff all the time. I will say the first episode, so it's 4 hours, about 1 hour episodes. I thought the first hour, not a lot happens. It's just sort of setting the stage, introducing us to all the characters. Like when the first episode ended, I was like, oh, was that it? Because like Amanda Root comes back and is talking to change was coming to Mansfield. Nice. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, like that went by really fast. Not much happened. Maybe they're less than an hour. But then things pick up.
They got through it. I have to say they did speed through the beginning of the story. They kind of sped through the trip to Sutherland. It all was happening quite fast. And then they get to Lover's Vows and they just did so many clever things to go jump forward faster. Like Mr.
They
Yates
did skip a lot from the Sutherland visit. We got a little bit of her like being left on her own and tired, but there's a whole bunch there that got cut for sure.
Yeah. But they left in the most important moments of them, you know, her making a joke about the clergy, and then they go outside and he feels the connection of her arm for the first time, like those emotional beats. And then when Rushworth comes back and he's pissed because Crawford and Mariah went through this locked door that everyone can apparently just pass through. It never really.
Well, no, they climbed over the fence. Julia was like, well, this sucks. I'm out of here. And I was kind of like, that was awesome. She just like full on threw herself over a fence, which I thought was pretty rad, actually. But there was no mention of the haha. And I was quite disappointed.
Yeah. And though I cannot get out, as the Starling said, but that's okay. That's okay. But yeah, they. Fanny is left on the bench and then they like cut. And that's fine. You know, some of the cuts, I will say I was a little bit whiplash. And part of that's just because I know the story.
Right.
Right. I was reading the like comments on the radio drama, like reviews from people who were like, and one of them said, I got very confused and it felt very jerky. I was like, where are they now? Mm-hmm. Where are they now? Where are they now? But, you know, to get a story like that into, I thought it was only 3 hours, actually.
Well, like, I thought it was four. I can check. I have it on Audible. You can download it on Audible, everyone. I signed up for an Audible account because of it.
And they,
there you go.
A whole hour after Henry Crawford proposes to her.
Oh, you're right. It's only 2 hours and 18 minutes. I don't know. I guess I just felt like it was longer because so much happened.
Yeah, so much does happen.
It's wild. Yeah. It's less than 2.5 hours.
Yeah. So, and then so when good. Once Crawford proposes to her, I look down at my ticker, my time, and it said 55 minutes left. And I'm like, okay, they're really going to nail it. They're really going to nail her in Portsmouth. Really going to nail. But I was surprised because they made some timeline adjustments so that Fanny, because it's a radio drama and you want people to be talking to each other.
So I thought it worked. I thought it worked too.
I thought it worked too. She's out of Portsmouth and she's getting a montage of letters, which was smart. But then as soon as Tom gets sick, they yank her back to Mansfield. And it's Sir Thomas who reads the article, the item, the blind item in the newspaper. And then Mary Crawford comes in person to tell her, hey, it'd be cool if Tom died.
Right. Which you kind of have to do. It's boring if she's just reading a letter, right? Yeah. And there was also a flashback. There were a couple flashbacks where they showed like Edmund and Mary talking to each other. I think there was a flashback of that.
Yes.
So if you weren't listening carefully, you might be confused as to where people were if you didn't catch like, oh, this is something that happened like off screen, kind of. Yes. But I loved that. Like as soon as Tom gets sick, everyone needs to be together. Like it was great. I thought that was a great decision, by the way.
The need to have dialogue also introduced a great little grace note that they added where Fanny is in Portsmouth with Susan. She's building that relationship with Susan and they read together.
But they read Shakespeare.
Read plays. They read Shakespeare out loud to each other. So you don't see Fanny as some kind of prude who doesn't approve mm-hmm. of things, you know, that she is imaginative and she does engage in that. And how much did you love Portsmouth? Just the way they did it.
Yes, I did. And I will say again, this is the second time I've seen, I can't remember which version of Mansfield Park it was, but the actress who played Susan was someone who's pretty well known now. And she was great. I thought the girl who played Susan was fantastic. I love Susan. And she does in the book, does she go to Mansfield Park with Fanny? Yeah. Okay, good. I was like, yay, Susan gets to get the hell out of here. Portsmouth sucks. But you know, at the very beginning, our narrator, who is Amanda Root, tells you that Fanny's mother had married foolishly. She'd married for love, which was just like such a beautiful, like, kind of that classic Austin kind of satire wordplay that I really love. It was just so good. Everybody listen to it. It was so good. Okay, sorry, Kristen. What else did you want to say?
No, that's okay. I mean, it's just I want to coo over like the way they did Portsmouth. I mean, it's annoying to listen to, you know, of course, but when
they're all shouting, all the kids are screaming shouting at each other.
And it's
actually, my shirt.
Yeah, hard to follow. And the father comes in and is like, pipe down, Earl, you know. And they're all just, it's this chaos that you can portray just with voices and so many clamoring voices where the younger brother, Sam, maybe needs his shirts to be finished so he can get off. You know, William comes in and his dad's like, the ship is already moored, you know, you're late, you got to get on the ship, they're going to take you out. And then it's just chaos. And he has to be like, Fanny's here. And the dad gets to say the line about like, you'll be wanting a husband soon. He doesn't even know what to say to her, and it just like made it all so real that
it's a little, sometimes I'm just kind of like, okay, just because you don't have a lot of money doesn't mean that everyone is like totally uncouth and everything. Yeah. I think it's just more a function of how many people were living in the space rather than the fact that like they're poor so they're rude. But I mean, she says in the very beginning, she's writing the letter to her sister. Doesn't she say, like, as I anticipate the birth of my 9th child or 11th child, you're like, oh my God, like you already are just like,
The book makes it very clear, too, that she's a very poor household manager, right? She hasn't been brought up to it. She's been brought up rich, and she's not like Mrs. Norris, who, as the book said, would have been a far more respectable mother of nine on a small income, because she knows how to budget. She knows how to do things. And so it's not just that they're poor. It was making it awful. But that was very effective.
Norris too nice. She seemed really terrible.
She didn't get the same ability to be evil. She didn't get
just sort of always like, well, I guess it's up to me, a poor widow, blah, blah, blah. I guess I'll have to do it. She's kind of always put upon and doesn't really do anything. But I don't think we really get her. She's not a villain, sort of.
She's not as evil and corrosive as in the book, because there just wasn't a lot of time. They do write barbs. They do leave in the considering who and what she is, and then the line where Edmund is too angry to speak, which does still seem like just so wishy-washy that she has, you know, Mary Crawford has to be Fanny's defender and take her aside and protect her emotionally from further harangue. Yeah. So they try to do a little bit, but it still just doesn't come across as like that evil Mrs. North.
Okay. And that's the only kind of real change, I think.
Yeah.
I wasn't really pleased with.
They weren't effective. Like, I think they tried, but they just didn't have enough space and time to do that kind of banality of evil kind of thing. And Lady Bertram wasn't as flaky or flighty. You know, the Lady Bertram with the pug.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't really do it. Again, she just kind of sat on the couch. Gotta love the pug. The pug got some good lines.
Yes.
Pug, don't eat it. Edmund doesn't agree with you.
At one point, Edmund is so fluttered and pressed over whether Mary Crawford loves him or not. This is, I think, is the before the ball, that he takes Pug out and is talking to Pug.
Yes, it's so genius. He's like monologuing to Pug while they're walking. And he's like, what do you think, Pug? And Pug's like, ooh.
They have a sound of him panting and stuff. Yeah,
it's 100% just a dude being like, like making the noise. They are not going to bring a dog into the studio to do that. This just makes me think of like the old radio shows where they just had sound people who would do the Foley.
Yeah, the Foley stuff. Okay, so notes wise. So Tom, he goes to Antigua, right? He comes back from Antigua, and he's back at home. The Crawfords are there. Mary Crawford's singing. By the way, she's singing, "My mother bids me bind my hair with bits."
My mother bids me to bind my hair. I was like, what a fun. I mean, it's got to be purposeful, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah,
It's got to be an Easter egg. They know what they're doing. Come on.
Yeah. But I enjoyed Tom and his sly humor. He's talking to Fanny about Edmund falling in love with Mary Crawford. And he says, "Are not all men essentially the same?" And Fanny pushes back and she's like, "I don't believe that."
He's like, "No."
She still has a higher bar. But this is another interesting sidebar. Tom talks about how awful it is to be in Antigua and you're getting fried in the sun and, you know, the accommodations aren't great, whatever. And then he talks about, oh, my father loves it. He loves to be in charge and arrange things and go into the field and run the plants through his fingers. And there is no explicit reference to the fact that human bondage is involved. And then tell me what you thought about this. Later, Sir Thomas comes home and they did a totally original scene where Sir Thomas goes to Fanny and says, "Fanny, things are changing. In 5, 10, 15 years, our way of life will be totally different." And Fanny says, "You're rooted here at Mansfield Park. You're like those trees. They change from year to year, but you'll always be rooted and you'll be loved for who you are here," or something. And I just were like, I don't know what they're doing here. I don't 100% know what societal change they're talking about. I don't know. Is this like slavery legislation in Britain is coming down the pipe or something?
I didn't read it as that. I think, I mean, the point of the piece is just about how everyone's worried about change, right? But Fanny is always just kind of like, if we just stay here where we know we belong, we'll weather it no matter what it is, right? And again, I think it was just another way to kind of show her as connected to Mansfield Park, another nature reference,
right,
with Fanny. We get a lot of Fanny at Mansfield Park nature references when they talk about cutting down things at Sutherland too. She's like, oh no, don't cut down the trees. I think it's just supposed, the rooting, I think, is like one of her real, one of her like real metaphors of her. She was ripped up from her home and transferred to Mansfield Park and planted there, but that's where she's blossomed. Do you know what I mean? So it's just sort of like, if we stay true to ourselves, if we stay true to the places we love, like we can, in terms of the change they're talking about broadly, I wouldn't give this, to me, this radio, you know, people have been talking about Mansfield Park and how it's been, there's readings of it, and Bay was asking about this actually, readings of it about slavery and the subtext and things like that. I do not think that this radio drama was interested in engaging with that, and that's fine. It doesn't have to. So I think it's just maybe more about how like the aristocracy, the landed gentry would soon not have as much money. Mm-hmm. I mean, the curve of history starting from that point is for more people to have more power. And I think they're just sort of hinting at that generally. I mean, I don't know enough about English history. Maybe the person who wrote this had something very specific in mind.
Yeah.
I just sort of interpret it as a general, like, well, in, you know, 100 years, these people are going to be land rich and money poor.
Yeah, I guess the Industrial Revolution and whatnot was going on. So like even in Sanditon, they say land isn't what it was. You're right. I think that's probably.
I don't want to answer as a expert, because again, the person who wrote it might have been referencing something specific that we just don't know about. But I don't think you need to know that to sort of understand what they're talking about.
I have another note, and we mentioned this already, but Fanny having scenes, specific scenes with Julia and later with Mariah after their feelings are extremely bruised makes her so sympathetic. So Julia has the big shit fit when she can't beat Agatha and storms out of the room. And the very next scene, Fanny goes to her and says, Julia, are you okay? And Julia's like, I could wish we never, you know, are doing this play, or, you know, like whatever. It's a exchange where Fanny can kind of counsel her into, I don't know, a calmer frame of mind. And that makes Fanny very sympathetic. You know, in the book, it's like there's two silent sufferers are connected only by Fanny's consciousness. It's like, yeah, go to her. You know, this is essentially your sister. And then later, after Mariah is at breakfast with Sir Thomas and Henry Crawford, and Henry Crawford's like, yeah, I'm leaving. You know, this is after he's pressed her hand to his heart. And he's like, yeah, I'm leaving. And she goes out. And there's a scene where you just hear Fanny's voice, and Fanny says, Mariah, come inside. It's cold. You're so cold. And that just rends your heart for Mariah in a way that having that character say something out loud could never do. And it shows Fanny's caring nature in a way that really makes you love her.
She comes off as very wise. Yeah, always giving good advice. She comes off as very wise. She comes off as smart. She comes off as very caring and very empathetic. She's very empathetic to a group of people who don't seem to ever care or notice how she feels.
Yeah, who don't deserve it.
Even Edmund.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly.
Actually, now that I think about it, at least in this, Mary Crawford is one of the only people who seems to actually care about Fanny. Like when she sees her walking by in the rain and brings her in and like makes her something, gives her some hot tea and helps her dry. Like that is one of the first times someone actually cares whether Fanny is okay in the whole thing.
We did lose Fanny Must Have a Horse. So we lost all that like little vignette about how Edmund wants her to have her horse. We did keep in how Edmund lets Fanny Crawford stay out with the horse too late, you know.
Oh, Mary, yeah.
Mary Crawford, excuse me.
Yeah, with Fanny's horse. Fanny's, I'm making horse. Little quotes, yeah. And then she doesn't ride for like 3 months or something like that, because Mary Crawford is always off riding.
Isn't it great how we don't have the one audiobook where Mary Crawford talks so slowly. Because I just remember saying, like, selfishness must be forgiven because there's no hope of a cure.
It's like, I'm so confused. I thought the actress was fantastic. She was great.
Yeah, she was really
and
great.
It seems like they were going for a sort of Mary Crawford's personality is very much informed by the people she's around. So when she's at Mansfield, she is like clever and nice, but she's nice and she genuinely cares about them. And when she says, you know, it's only been 6 months, but I feel like it's a family that I'm with, like you believe her. And then there's a lot of this when she goes back to her other friends, they start poisoning her and like, you know, she starts going down this like sort of darker path that leads to her being like, well, Tom's totally going to die. So this could work out pretty well. And it's not like it's her fault. There, I think I heard like three different references to and Edmund even says it. It's like, well, it's just the people she was hanging out with. They've just totally changed her. And I thought that was interesting.
You know what?
I don't know if it's in the book, but I noticed it in this for sure.
Absolutely. It's in the book where he's like, her friends are, you know, have turned her mind. And that's so insightful that she does. When she leaves Mansfield, she says, you all have so much heart among you. Mm-hmm. And Henry Crawford seems to feel the same way, that he's come to the country and all of a sudden he has value for this sort of empathetic, religious woman, principled woman, that if he were in London, man, not even interested. You know, it's so true. This is a digression, but when he goes to Portsmouth and Fanny's there and he's looking for her opinion and approval, and he comes and he says, I've gone back to my estate. I've looked into some cottages there. I have tenants I never even knew about. And he wants her approval because he's adopted a way of life and a way of thinking that's totally new. And he's such a weak character that he says, do you think I should go back? Do you think I should go back again? And she has to say, we all have a better guide inside of us. But when she says it, and I know I already said this, but I'll say it again in a longer, more verbose way. When she says that to him in this radio drama, it's not a prudish little Sunday school lesson. It's a thing where he is so lost as just a human being to principle. You know, the general idea that he has to be a steward of land and people. And when he asks her this, totally, it's not a naive question. It's just that he's just so at sea with the idea of his responsibilities. It just really illustrates he is not ready for, he's not the man that she needs. He's not a man that she can respect. And it's this very gentle counsel, like you'd say to a child, like, well, we have a better guide inside of us. I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Yeah, I see that.
You know what to do.
I see what you're saying. I actually had a different interpretation of that. I interpret it as he respects her so much and her opinion that he asks her, because it's basically like, I know you will have the answer. And of course, it's something she doesn't know anything about. She doesn't know anything about running his estate. And so she's basically like, well, I don't know. Like, you're the one who knows. Yeah. So it's sort of like her even like telling him, like, the answer was inside you all alone. It's like me with Alex. You can do it. Just try. Like, you can do it. So it actually, I had kind of a different response to it, where I'm like, he so respects her opinion that he wants to know what she thinks about something, even if it's outside her realm of experience. And then she's supporting him to be like, you know that you can answer this yourself.
There's a theory in education, the field of education, called the zone of proximal development, where a student, a child, can't do something on their own quite yet. But if you're there, and you've modeled the behavior, and they're with you, they're in the zone of proximal development, where if they just have that little bit of support or encouragement, then they can do it.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's where he is. He's in a zone of development. And that's why it's so heartbreaking when he just goes. And you know what? That is the shortfall. That is a failing of this radio drama, because you truly do not understand what happened with them. How did he go from loving Fanny Price to just going to London and all of a sudden eloping? They needed at least one scene where he's at Mariah's party and Mariah's mean to him and he's peaked and he like tries to get her back on his side.
But he's just like, I'll never win her. It's over. And so he just does that because he's like drunk and desperate and heartbroken. But I mean, that they leave a lot of ambiguity there, which I like, where it's like, the eternal question, did Henry Crawford really love Fanny Price? And so the ambiguity, I think, without that scene, you still don't know. Right.
Yeah.
Why did he go off with Mariah? Did he really not love Fanny? Is it all like kind of an act? Did he just convince himself he'd changed? Was he heartbroken because she had he finally believed she would never pick him? And so he just did something really stupid because he was really depressed and sad about, you know, we don't know.
Yeah. I'm a little bit worried about people who are unfamiliar with the story going, wow, that was a real deus ex machina. You know,
that's Austin.
Yeah, well.
Okay, come on. Remember Northanger Abbey when it's like, oh my God, the guy that she was in love with inherited all this money and they could be together.
Yeah, no, I mean, the book has far more support for what Henry does. The book goes into that actual scene, you know, when she's frosty to him. Or not, it's not verbal, there's no dialogue, but there's a description of what happens. And he's like, I'm going to make Mrs. Rushworth Mariah Bertram again in her treatment of me. And that's how he traps himself into this invidious situation. And that's what the radio drama is missing, just that one little link that would have made it clear. Yeah. And like, certainly the same problem, what we would call a problem, still exists when Edmund goes to marry. They kept this scene in where after they elope, Edmund goes to Mary and she's like, can you believe the folly of our two relations? And he's horrified because she wants this marriage. And, you know, it all just seems very practical to us, the modern listener. I mean, that problem was
the fact that they got caught, not that they did it, that offended her.
Sorry, this is a total digression.
There is no digression. We're just shooting the shit. There's no digression. We're just chatting.
Sorry. Were you going to say something? Because I like totally seized control.
No, I just like hearing what you say and then responding to it. That's our vibe, Kristen.
We also lost. This was a bummer to me. At the end of Lover's Vows, right? In the book, there's this whole big buildup where they're going to do the first run through, the first read through. And they're all up on stage in the middle of a scene. And Julia bursts in. My father has come. And then it's like shit hits the fan. They didn't bother setting it up at all. So
you don't need it.
Just a little bit of rehearsal. And it wasn't really needed, but it definitely took the panic away a little bit. Well, she does burst in. She's like, my father has come. And like,
okay, but it's really funny when Tom's like, our father's locked in the library with Mr. Yates. And they're all like, oh. Oh my God, he's in there with Mr. Yates. And they're like, well, you know, he's an idiot. So this is not going well.
Yeah. And all,
but we still got the discussion about like the pink cloak.
Yep.
And the Tom's outfit changes.
You have to keep that stuff in. And I liked that we got Rushworth reading lines and Tom going, not my pleasure, my honor, and like interrupting him constantly. Rushworth does a lot better in this radio drama at remembering his lines than I think we're supposed to take away from the actual book.
Well, Toby Jones is too much of a professional to try to imply that he doesn't know what he's doing.
That's right. I feel like Rushworth didn't seem like as much of a doofus. Like, he's really not bright.
Yeah. But I think Toby Jones is so charismatic again. Like, you just like everybody. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even Mrs. Norris comes off okay because everybody's so good. He just is sort of like, blah. Not Toby Jones, obviously, but Mr. Rushworth doesn't seem like a fool. He just seems like someone who doesn't have a lot of personality.
He's someone ordinary contrasted with someone extraordinary.
Yeah.
Right? Rather than a complete buffoon who you cannot believe she is marrying.
Yeah. And maybe that's more realistic, right?
Yeah, it certainly makes him a more sympathetic character. Really does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just to revisit something I wanted to say this earlier. what I was saying about how I feel like the piece itself is making the point that Mary Crawford changed after leaving Mansfield, the narrator herself says this too. So it's not like it's just Edmund wants to believe that because he doesn't want to believe the person he loved was like this. Just that Fanny doesn't want to believe that because she is distrustful of anyone not within her circle. Like the narrator, the person who speaks with the voice of the piece, mentions that Mary Crawford is hanging out with her old friends again and has been changing. So it's sort of like baked into the thing that that's the thesis, is that she has altered. Maybe Mansfield Park is supposed to be like this little bubble that because Fanny is there, it's got, is it Ted Lasso energy where when Fanny is in a place, like the ripples spread out and she positively changes the people around her?
I would believe that in this adaptation. I do think, speaking of Mary Crawford and speaking of her sort of change, I do think there was a missed opportunity. So I think her change begins even before she leaves Mansfield, when she's like thinking of going to London, right? When I think you would agree, like she's like, oh,
when
my
Edmund leaves, maybe.
Yeah. And so Edmund is like the night of the ball. What I've always wanted, and the opportunity we missed again here with this adaptation, I've always wanted a scene between Edmund and Mary that night where they come to the point where she's really mean. You know, it says in the book, she's mean and she says, I'll never dance with a clergyman. You don't hear them have it out. They don't have a big fight. She just is rude and then regrets it. I really want him to be able to say, Mary, what do you want me to do? Look around you. I've been born to this house. None of this is mine. I want a moment where he asks, think about how that makes me feel.
Kristen, that's a modern reader thing, though. Nobody ever talks about their actual feelings, especially not in the 1800s. Come on. Nobody did that.
This radio drama definitely has the big fight between Edmund and Fanny, which is, as written in the book, they're just having a fond conversation where he's like counseling her.
It's about Henry.
And they turn it into a fight in this drama. And I feel like they're willing to be more explicit about feelings because they have limited time and they want to like bring those. I really miss it. I know he's too good and too staid and stolid and accepting of the current order, natural order. I think you're right that he wouldn't have said it organically as like a character back in that time. However,
he doesn't come off well in that fight either, because she's like, I know you're going to say I should marry him. He's like, no, you should do. If you don't love him, you shouldn't do it. And she's like, oh, thank God you support me. And then he's like, but maybe you could love him. And she's like, oh, my God.
And they're on horses.
Not you too.
She rides away in an angry huff, which is satisfying.
I will tell you one thing. The thing that let me down was that we didn't get like an actual romantic scene between the two of them. The narrator is like, oh, he realized that, you know, the perfect woman was right there. And then they're like doing a cute ride where he's like, when I said we should race, I didn't mean you should win. But there was no like actual, if it was a movie, there wasn't a kiss scene, right?
Yeah.
And I really wanted that.
Agreed. You know, that's
really
that point. I mean, Henry Crawford got to have all of these love-stricken
romantic speeches, and
we still never got to this place where it's like, wow, I'm really happy Edmund married Fanny. They really hit it off there at the end, and at a very
well, he got it with Mary Crawford during Lover's Vow. I wanted something with him, like being romantic to Fanny, and like that wasn't apparently important, I guess.
Yeah, it's such a shame. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Well, maybe the radio drama thought that Henry Crawford was like the romantic choice. But Edmund's not the romantic choice. Edmund is like the choice that makes sense and is practical and makes sense. And I said that twice. But you know what? That's just like the kind of the thing. It's a great match. Good for Fanny. But it's not like there's a lot of romance there.
It's certainly her like unrequited thing. But it still doesn't have the sexual charisma tension.
Yeah. Let Fanny Price be sexy. No one is ever going to accuse Fanny Price of being sexy.
Babies, write it. I know that.
Where's the Mansfield Park adaptation?
Roy, she's like, it's my nightmare for Davies to write Mansfield Park. He's going to sex up Fanny.
And I'd love it. I love it. Mansfield Park is like begging to be. Okay, the whole lover's vow thing and the whole Mariah and like Mansfield Park is pretty sexy. The problem with Mansfield Park is that the main characters are not the ones who are sexy, right? Yeah. It's like all around them. And then they're in here like really boring. And I don't know if that's what Jane Austen was going. This is because it just seems very different from her other stuff, right? Because it seems very, not heteronormative, that's not the word I'm looking for, but like just very like traditional Christian values and virtues. And that's not usually what I think about. Yeah, it needs to be more sexy. They need to be more sexy.
I think my idea, I think that if you do an adaptation, I mean, Fanny is so isolated, so young, only has Edmund to tell her about things and tell her about the world and show her about the world, that she, you have to portray her as having a sexual awakening and not being confused, like not knowing what to do with these feelings and having no one to guide her at all. And it becomes this obsession with Edmund. You have to write something in to show her physical desire for him.
Just do a black, like in a Black Swan. Remember where she like masturbates and her mom is in the room?
Damn. I do not remember that.
Oh my God. She like wakes up one morning and she's like, let's go for it. Cause that's her homework, right? The director tells her to like go home and pleasure herself. She wait and she's like, okay, I'm going to go for it. And then she looks over and her mom had like fallen asleep in a chair in her room. And she had been like touching herself when her mom was in the room. And she's like, ah, and I hoped you would get that joke and you didn't. So now it's just weird. Anyway, Black Swan was really messed up. Okay, but just file this away for when we do our adaptation, Kristen, that we're going to make it, we're going to make Edmund and Fanny actually like have some heat.
But, you know, Kevin always talks about, like, you should do an adaptation. And listening to this made me realize how, like, bad I would be at it and how not ready I am. And, like,
no, you wouldn't. You'd be great.
There are choices. Like, there are so many choices that you make. And it has to be well thought out.
Really?
Well thought out.
You just get screenwriting for dummies. You're going to do great. As far, the first thing I think that you really need to do is you don't just sit down and start writing. You get a big board, you write down your big story beats and you like put them on the board at like where you want, you know, if you're first at your three act structure, you have to figure out what beats go where, and then you sort of write around that.
You got to have all these themes and you got to know where you're going, and you can't throw the kitchen sink, and you have to kill your darlings, except in this case, it's Austin's darling. And that's very, very difficult.
Yeah, you could do it. Just get David Tennant to be in it and it'll be great.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like you said, performances just elevate the material.
It's really too bad, though, because I was also just thinking, oh, this is the dream cast. And then I'm like, well, 20 years ago. Sorry, guys. I mean, Benedict Cumberbatch is not 25 or 22 or whatever he's supposed to be. You know what I'm saying?
He's still hot in Doctor Strange, but yeah.
Oh, I don't totally. Think but I mean, he's older than me and I'm pretty old now, so.
It's such a bummer because I really want to have like a super horny crush on him as Doctor Strange, but the character sucks. Like,
yeah, he's kind of an a-hole. They should have let him be British.
Just, I know.
Let Benedict Cumberbatch be British. Let David Tennant be Scottish. Like, let's just let people be who they are. Like, anytime, what is his name? Anytime I see... Oh, God. What's the guy who's like, this is Sparta? What is that guy's name?
Gerard.
Who was
Butler.
Phantom of the Opera. Anytime I see Gerard Butler, if he is not Scottish, I'm like, what the fuck are we doing here, people?
What are we doing with our lives?
Why are you going to hire Gerard Butler and then make him use this like mid-Atlantic, boring American accent? Why? You know what you do? You put in one line. Oh, yeah. My parents, I was, you know, my dad was like U.S. Army, married a Scots woman. We moved. You know, all it takes is one line to explain why he's Scottish in a movie. It's fine.
Yeah.
He's in the Secret Service or whatever. Like, isn't he in White House Down or something like that? Just one line to explain. It's fine. It's fine. The Phantom of the Opera can be Scottish. It's fine.
Fine.
Nobody cares. House could have been British.
Yeah. Yeah, why
Hugh
not?
Hugh Laurie. Yeah, right? I didn't even know Hugh Laurie was English, though. That's how good his accent is.
His accent is top-notch. Well, what's his face gets to be the Australian, because he is Australian. And
what's
so maybe
his face? Hugh Jackman?
No, in House, the blonde guy, Jesse Spencer, he gets to be Australian because he is Australian.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the young, hot doctor guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people are Australian that you don't know.
A lot of people are Australian that you don't know.
So Bay, my husband Bay, he gets really upset when he finds out that actors he really likes are Australian. Because for some reason, he really hates Australian accents. Oh. They drive him crazy. Yeah, he really hates them. They like, it's like fingernails on a child. It doesn't make any sense, people. But I'll be like, you know, they're Australian. And he's like, he gets so mad. Like Margot Robbie. Oh, he was so mad when he found
Margot Robbie's Australian. Where have I been?
You didn't know that?
No.
Everybody's Australian now. I told you.
That's right. I love an Australian accent. I think it's really appealing. I was in love with Jesse Spencer. I mean, recently I rewatched House, and I recently got the kind of crush on Jesse Spencer that had me on Tumblr looking at House GIF accounts and like House, you know, like all the scenes, and they like make it into those little memes with all the lines. Oh my God.
This is like me in 2001 in my dorm, like Googling people that I really liked. This is when there were still like 10 internet browsers, and I was just looking up guys that I thought were hot in the early days of the internet.
You're on net.
I preferred someone with a Mount Vista or something. No, I actually thought I really liked messing around with Ask Jeeves because I thought that was just really cute that you could ask. Do you remember Ask Jeeves?
Yeah.
This is such a tangent. You can cut it out. I specifically remember watching Angel my sophomore year of college. And this is a big spoiler for the first season of Angel. So stop listening if you don't want to hear it. But Doyle dies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like in the fifth episode or something. And Joss Whedon purposefully did it to show like, this is a different show. Nobody is safe. I will kill characters. I was so devastated. I got obsessed about reading spoilers. And so I was like trolling every Angel Buffy website I could find, trying to find spoilers, because I did not want to be heartbroken like that again.
Oh, I know.
I was so upset.
Right. Well, you know, that actor had a drug problem.
No, and then he later died in real life. It was very sad.
I think that's why they had to do it so soon, though, because it was like he wasn't showing up and he didn't know his life.
Well, I hadn't heard that. I mean, the only things I read was that Joss Whedon had planned it from the beginning. He had told him, like, this is not a full season. You're only contracted. We want to really, like, this isn't an adult show compared to Buffy. We want to show to people that we're, like, operating at a different level here. I hadn't heard that. It was a response to that. That's interesting.
You must be right. I mean, my mom was so into Angel and Buffy. She was on the boards, you know, the discussion boards that you would type first when the page refreshed because to be at the top of the page. Anyway.
Now you would say first.
Yes.
To try to be the first person to leave a comment.
She was a member of an organization called Viewers for Quality Television, which only existed in the late 90s. And they would give out awards. And they got so big that these actors started coming to receive their cues.
Amazing story, Kristen.
It's wild. You go to her house and you look at her photo albums. And she has pictures with her and Joss Whedon, pictures with her and everybody. Allison Hannigan. She was actually, Allison Hannigan wasn't there, like the event that she went to. But yeah. So my mom met Joss Whedon, right? And my mom leaned in and whispered to him, "Thank you for the hours of pleasure that you..."
No, absolutely not.
He said he laughed and she was so proud of herself.
Absolutely not. Especially now that we know everything we know about Joss Whedon.
She feels bad now. Like, nobody knew he was a bad guy at the time.
Okay,
right?
But that is such an incredible story. I can't believe. I love your mom so much. I've only met your mom like twice, which is kind of wild considering how long we've known each other. But like, her obsession with Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, yeah.
This story, like, oh, man. Your mom, this is gold.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to be in that group. That sounds so fun.
Yeah, it dissolved.
I once got sent a Nielsen survey.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's fun. That's exciting, isn't it? You're like, oh, my opinion matters.
Yeah, that's it. I wasn't like a Nielsen household, but I did fill out a survey once in the mail. Like, it was an actual legit random survey.
Cash in the envelope? I got $5 in cash. They shouldn't be.
I don't know if I got any money.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was because at the time I had the TV blog. I was like, oh, maybe they've like turned on to my TV blog.
Yeah. TV Sluts? What was it
called? Yeah, hell yeah. It was called TV Sluts.
Nice.
It was great. Well, it was really called We're Wicked Smart. But the URL was tvsluts.com. And then people were like, are you sure you want it to be that? I was like, well, that's great.
You could have sold that for a lot of money, that domain. Like,
yeah, right. Or it was tvsluts.blogspot. This is Blogspot. This was like 2005. Mm-hmm. At one point, I had like five or six people writing for me. It was just my friends. They would just do it for free, but it was really cool.
No, I remember this because somehow I got on the list of people you would email and chastise for not making the deadline.
Well, nobody ever actually. I had to really browbeat people. If you don't offer money, there's no incentive and people don't do it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is why Nielsen sends out $5 because they know you. Then you feel obligated to return the survey, right? Yeah. This is why the charities send you like address labels.
Yeah, I know. And the International Refugee Committee or whatever, the IRC, I have to figure out how to get off their list because they send me greeting cards.
And then you feel bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, please don't waste your money. I mean, I give, but I have organizations that I give to every month. So, yeah. So it's like, I'm just maxed out on those. I'm not looking for like a new thing to give to. So anyway.
Kristen, are we done talking about Mansfield Park?
I think I'm done. I went through all my notes and I just loved it so much. Thank you so much for telling me how much you loved it and getting me into like this super hyped headspace. And then it turned
Everyone, I have to let everyone know. I couldn't believe it. I listened to it and I loved it. And I messaged Kristen and I was like, oh my God, Kristen, this is so good. It's so amazing. Thank you for telling me about it. And she was like, oh, I haven't listened yet. And I was like, oh, I thought for sure anything Mansfield Park related, but I'd forgotten about your not liking audio storytelling that much, which I assume was kind of a barrier for you to like dive right in.
It was. And the other thing was work. For the record, whoever is listening, I just wound up cutting it all out.
Yeah, put that part in though. But it'd just be like a do. At this point, I told a really long story about how I messed up something at work. A long
story about a super traumatic thing that happened at work. That it, yeah. But
then, so that everybody knows, everything ended up fine. Don't worry, Kristen's fine.
God, I hope you're right. It's cool that you're in therapy. I saw my doctor who does my med adjustments, and I was telling her this story, and it took me like 15 minutes to tell this story. And she was like, wow, that was her first thing she said was, that was a long way around that story. And then she's rude as fuck. Like, she's.
Oh, well, sometimes you want your therapist to be rude. No, they calls it a shaggy dog story.
This is the point she's making. She's like, that was for your therapist.
I'm your pharmacy medication manager. I just need to make sure that you're not going to die if you take like this and this together.
And then she goes, okay, you're clearly hyperverbal. I'm prescribing you this to bring you down out of hypomania. And like, then she's like, go see your therapist. And I'm like, I don't have one. she's like, you probably need
a Well, I love having a therapist. We've actually heard from several people that they appreciate us being open about our mental health struggles. So I will say that I started seeing a therapist after my son was born a few months after, because I had developed really bad anxiety due to the pandemic and having a baby. and your brain chemistry changes, and it was crazy. And I actually started, my big news for the new year is that I started an as-needed anti-anxiety medication, which I didn't know was a thing. I thought you had to take like a daily. You don't. They have as-needed. So when you start to feel yourself sort of like spiraling, you can take it and it helps. And it's so great. I love it. I've only needed it maybe 5 times in January, but it's just even just knowing it's there is so wonderful.
Yeah, that's
great. And it helps me sort of like identify the triggers of things that, you know, start to get me spiraling up into anxiety. And it's just so great. I highly recommend anti-anxiety medication for everyone. What I
recommend is the drugs. Yeah.
Well, and also like finally it started because the holidays were so, I didn't realize I was spinning out a lot. But right before Christmas, we got a message from my mom that she had COVID. She had COVID last year at Christmas. And it was like 3 days before Christmas Day. And she texted me and she's like, well, I've got COVID. And she had just been over to our house the night before. We were with my husband's family, including our baby niece, who was only like 5 months old at the time. And I basically had a panic attack in front of my in-laws. Because for me, one of the big triggers of anxiety is health stuff. Mm. And COVID for some is like a huge one. And I was just like, I can't go through my life having these overblown reactions to things where like I'm nauseous for 3 days and things like that. So I decided to ask my doctor for an anti-anxiety medication, which she was totally supportive of. But just making that decision and making a positive step to help myself felt so good. Because we feel powerless, right?
Yeah.
But if you can actually do something to sort of not even control, but like try to move the needle towards helping yourself, I find it so beneficial.
Well, unless we have anything else to share, any like TV shows or anything, we can.
Before we do that, we need to give a shout out. We need to go to the Weechi.
Oh, yeah. Because
we had a really lovely email. Lisa sent us such a wonderful email where she has listened to all of our episodes starting at the beginning. And she promised herself when she reached the end, when she caught up, she was going to email us and reach out. And I'm so glad she did. It was such a lovely message to receive. It really made my day to hear from her. Yeah, it was so sweet. Yeah. So, Kristen.
Yeah, I was having a really bad day. It was really nice to get that.
Oh, so Lisa, thank you so much. We loved hearing from you.
Thank you so much.
And for anyone else who wants to reach out, please do. Kristen, what's our email address?
It is first.impressions.podcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We are... Oh, God, it's not Twitter. X. Do I have to say that? It's Twitter. Come on. Yeah, please reach out.
I'll never stop calling it Twitter.
Do you have anything that you want to recommend?
We're watching Station 11 on HBO.
Oh.
You have to be in the right headspace. Like, you have to be prepared to receive information that might hurt you. Like, it's about a pandemic that causes the end of civilization and... Yeah, but it's extraordinary. Like, if you can get through like the first episode, which is a little bit slow, but we were hooked.
I read the book and I thought it was beautiful. The book came out pre-COVID by several years. I will not watch this show.
Mm.
My vibe for 2024 is no bummers. I have like a strict no bummers policy. I don't know if I'd say that it's like all a bummer, but there's a lot of bummers in Station 11. And so I'm not going to engage with that. Thank you very much. I love this idea, though, like the traveling Shakespeare company. What is it? Survival is not sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, like we can't just survive. You have to have art. You have to have beauty. There has to be something. We're humans. We need it. I loved that sentiment. But yeah, I can't do the show.
Yeah. No, understood. Like, Kevin has this other thing where he has a long list of movies that he's always wanted to watch or he like missed. You know, he's like, we're going to watch movies. And I'm like, damn it. Because like a movie is such a commitment. We finally watched the Dungeons and Dragons movie, which I know it was so great. It was so, it starts slow. Like you have,
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. Oh, I loved it. And there's this line, Chris Pine, who stars in it, gets this line and it got me through the week. It was, we can never stop failing.
Stop failing.
Because
when you stop failing,
we failed.
Yeah. I thought that movie is so incredible. I'm a big D&D fan. I run a D&D 5th edition game every month. I've been a fan since I was a kid. I went into it with really low expectations because every time they've tried to do a movie in it, it's terrible. And it was so good. I rented a private theater for my birthday the year it came out and hosted like 30 people to watch it with me. Was how much I loved that movie. That was what I did for my birthday that year. I loved it. And this was back. So when that came out, though, it was not super expensive to do that because AMC just wanted people in the theater, right? So you could do it for like $150 or something. It was crazy. Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. I love that movie so much.
Loved it.
That's good. What have we been watching? We finished Lupin, which is really fun. Bay and I are really into like mysteries and puzzles and heists and things. We've been doing a lot of logic puzzle video games. Mm. Something called The Case of the Golden Idol, which was great. They're really fun to do with someone else. You can sort of play off each other with it. I've been reading a lot. I read Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone, which was really fun. And the sequel just came out. Yeah, again, but like a cozy murder mystery is okay. That's not a bummer.
Yeah.
It has to be cozy. Yeah.
We've been rewatching Columbo.
Oh my God.
I know.
Just one more thing.
One more thing.
What's up? Okay. When I was a kid, I always wondered, did Peter Falk like have a stroke or something? Why was like one eye always closed? Do you know what I mean? Was that just an affectation for Columbo, or was that how his face was?
Do you find him weirdly hot? Because I do.
You're not alone in that sentiment. I personally, not really, but I know that you are not alone. I won't tell you how I know that you're not alone. But that's not an unusual response. And he also wasn't that old. As a child, I remember thinking like, oh, this old guy. But he was probably like 50 when they were making that.
Younger than that, he had this full thick head of hair.
He was probably my age. But when you're a kid, I was like, oh, he's so old.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad. So you're just like panting over Peter Falk.
I have a problem.
Oh, before we go, we have to talk about Love You, Ari.
Oh, yeah.
On the Hallmark Channel.
I saw Paging Mr. Darcy last night. You're going to love it.
I have recorded it on the DVR. I haven't watched it yet. I'm very excited. I've heard there's a new Jane Austen themed movie every Saturday evening in February on Hallmark Channel.
Yes, that's called Love You, Ari. And they did the first one this past yesterday. And I forgot it was happening, but then I saw Jane Austen First Drafts posted about it. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to get the app and like watch it really fast. And like whoever wrote it, her name is Rina Hardy. She clearly did her homework. She clearly read Among the Janeites. She clearly read Camp Austin. She wrote this hilarious. And like having been to Jasnah, it's just like Jasnah.
Oh, I can't wait.
Eula love story about.
It's about a Jane Austen scholar, right?
Yes, she gives a keynote. She's going to give a keynote at the Jane Austen League of America, JALA, right?
Okay.
They did all these little cute like tweaks, so it's not like real. Yeah. You know, she gets a fake Mr. Darcy assigned to her to be her like conference liaison. And of course,
they fall in love.
First they clash and then they, yeah.
So, and it's culminating in a new Sense and Sensibility movie at the end of the month.
But there's one coming up where it's a librarian is the main character and like Jane Austen gives her like advice or something. So it's my exact profession and my exact hobby. And I'm like going to watch it, but I'm probably going to hate it. So I'm going to
hate it. Oh, yeah, you're going to hate it. You're absolutely going to hate it. It's like she has visions of Jane.
There are going to be so many librarian tropes. Maybe I've conflated the two different plots. But anyway,
we'll see. You will hate it, I'm sure.
Infuriated. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe we can talk about some of these in a future episode. We'll do like a Loveuary recap. Yes, oh, God, do I have to watch all these movies now?
You don't act like you're so put upon. You want to watch them.
I only watched two romantic comedies in all of December.
Oh, and December. Oh, wow.
Yes. Well, usually I'd be glued to the Hallmark channel. I didn't watch any on Hallmark. They were both on Netflix. Thank you very much. I was very proud of myself. I was busy.
Good job. Good job.
Yes. Maybe that's why I was so anxious.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. See, ask your therapist.
Yeah. I'm meeting with her tomorrow morning. I will.
Say hi.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. All right.
All right. Always a pleasure, Kristen.
Yeah, you say the
thing. Yeah, we should say the thing. Me say the thing?
Yeah.
All right. Listeners, we have delighted you long enough. Thank you for joining us. Bye.
Bye.